The Caribbean is a region defined by movement. For decades, our greatest export has not been sugar, bauxite, or oil. It has been people. This is a story of the invisible threads that stretch from the cold pavements of London, Toronto, and New York back to the heat of the islands. We call it the remittance economy. To the economist, it is a line on a spreadsheet representing billions of dollars in foreign exchange. To the mother in a rural village, it is the difference between a roof that leaks and a roof of corrugated zinc. To the migrant working three jobs in a basement in Queens, it is a crushing, silent weight. This is the history of the obligation that built our modern world. It is a story of money that travels where people cannot. It is a story of how our survival became dependent on the sacrifice of those who left. We must look at the cost of this lifeblood. Chapter 1. The Departure Contract. The 1970s marked a period of profound shifting for our islands. The initial euphoria of independence had begun to collide with the cold reality of global markets. Across the Caribbean, from the hills of Jamaica to the coastal plains of Guyana, the dream of self-sufficiency was fraying at the edges. Inflation climbed, opportunities for the youth evaporated. The decision to leave was rarely a solo choice. It was a family investment. When a young man or woman boarded a plane in 1974, they did not just carry a suitcase, they carried the expectations of an entire household. This was the birth of the departure contract. It was an unwritten, unspoken agreement. The family would pool their meager resources to buy a one-way ticket. They would sell a plot of land, or slaughter their best livestock to pay for the visa fees. In exchange, the migrant accepted a life of permanent debt. The goal was simple. You go there so we can stay here. The 1970s saw the rise of the shipping barrel as the first physical manifestation of this contract. These blue plastic or cardboard cylinders became the most important vessels in Caribbean history. Inside these barrels, history was packed tight. It was not just about cash in the early days. It was about the things the local economy could no longer provide. Flour, rice, canned meats, used clothing, soap. The act of packing a barrel was an act of meticulous curation. The migrant in Brooklyn would spend months gathering items, wait for a sale, and store goods under their bed until the barrel was full. When that barrel arrived at a wharf in Kingston or Port of Spain, it was a holiday. It was proof that the link had not been broken. But the psychological toll on the sender was immense. We see the photos of the success, but we rarely talk about the struggle to produce it. In the 1970s, many of our people were entering the lowest rungs of the service economy in the North. They were nursing assistants, factory hands, and seasonal laborers. They lived in overcrowded apartments to save every penny. The obligation was a shadow that followed them. Every meal they ate in New York was weighed against what that money could buy back home. If they spent $10 on a movie, that was $10 less for their grandmother's medicine. This created a specific type of Caribbean identity. The migrant lived in a state of suspended animation. They were physically in the North, but their mind was always in the archipelago. They lived for the letters and the crackling long-distance phone calls. The pressure to prove that the migration was worth it led to a culture of performance. The migrant had to send money, even if they were starving. To stop sending was to admit failure. To stop sending was to break the contract and abandon the bloodline. By the late 1970s, governments across the region began to realize that these private flows of cash were becoming a pillar of the national economy. The central banks noticed that the influx of foreign currency was keeping the island's balance of payments from collapsing. The state began to rely on the migrant just as much as the family did. It was a convenient arrangement for the ruling class. If the diaspora took care of the poor, the government did not have to. The migration became a safety valve for social unrest. If people were frustrated, they didn't protest. They planned their exit. This period solidified the remittance as more than just a gift. It was a tax paid by the brave to support the abandoned. It was a redistribution of wealth that happened outside of government control. It was the only social security system that actually worked. However, the reliance on these funds created a new kind of vulnerability. We were no longer just at the mercy of the weather or the price of sugar. We were now at the mercy of the labor markets in foreign lands. If the factories in the North closed, the kitchens in the South went cold. As the decade came to a close, The scale of the operation shifted. The informal networks of friends carrying envelopes of cash were no longer enough. The volume of money was growing too large for the shadows. The Caribbean was becoming a captive market for a new kind of industry. The era of the shipping barrel and the hidden envelope was about to meet the era of the global financier. The cost of sending home a piece of one's soul was about to go up. The migrant stood on a street corner in a freezing winter, clutching a wad of bills. They had fulfilled their end of the deal. They had survived the winter. They had earned the keep. But as they looked for a way to send that money across the sea, they realized they were walking into a new kind of trap. Chapter 2: The Middleman's Cut. The 1980s and 90s saw the formalization of the remittance industry. As the diaspora grew in size and the volume of cash reached hundreds of millions of dollars, the big players moved in. Names like Western Union and MoneyGram became as familiar in our neighborhoods as the local grocery store. For the migrant, these yellow and red signs were beacons of hope. They represented the fastest way to get money to a sick relative or pay a school fee before the deadline. But this speed came with a predatory price. During this era, the Caribbean became one of the most expensive corridors in the world for moving money. The fees were staggering. It was not uncommon for a middleman to take 15 or 20% of the total amount sent. If a worker in London sent £50 home to Grenada, nearly £10 disappeared into the pockets of a corporation that had no stake in our development. This was a private tax on the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere. It was a transfer of wealth from the hard-working immigrant back into the coffers of global finance. The logic of the companies was cold. They claimed the high fees were necessary because of the lack of banking infrastructure in the islands. They charged for the risk. They charged for the convenience. But for our people, there was no choice. Most of the recipients in the Caribbean were unbanked. They did not have accounts or credit cards. They relied on cash. This meant they had to travel to a physical office, often in the heat of the day, and wait in long lines to collect what was left of their relatives' hard work. The middleman did not just take money. They took time. They took dignity. The power dynamic was clear. The corporation held the money hostage until the fee was paid. We saw the rise of a new architecture in our towns. The most prominent, best-guarded buildings were often the wire transfer stations. They were the temples of the remittance age. While the local agricultural sectors were failing, and the manufacturing plants were closing, these offices thrived. They were the only businesses that never saw a recession. While the money flowed, the social fabric was tearing in a different way. This period saw the peak of the barrel children phenomenon. These were the children left behind with grandmothers or aunts, while their parents went north to work. The parent was reduced to a voice on a phone and a monthly money order. The child grew up with every material need met, the best sneakers, the latest gadgets, the finest clothes, but they lacked a mother or a father. The remittance became a substitute for presents. This created a profound emotional complication in our history. The money was a sign of love, but it was also a source of resentment. The child felt abandoned. The parent felt unappreciated for their sacrifice. The middleman sat in between this pain and took a cut of every transaction. The barrel child grew up in a house built by remittances, but often felt like a stranger in their own family. The obligation of the migrant had created a generation of youth who looked at the horizon as their only future. They did not want to build their island. They wanted to join the queue to leave it. By the mid-1990s, the total value of remittances began to outpace foreign direct investment and even official development aid in several Caribbean nations. Our countries were being kept afloat by the individual choices of millions of waitresses, taxi drivers, and hotel cleaners. This gave the diaspora a new kind of power, but it was a power they were often too tired to use. They were too busy working the double shifts required to cover both their rent in Miami and the mortgage in Georgetown. The governments of the region remained complicit. They did little to regulate the fees of the wire transfer giants. Why would they? The steady flow of US dollars helped stabilize the national currency. It reduced the demand for social services. It was the perfect subsidy. The state had outsourced its responsibility to the diaspora. If the hospitals were failing, the migrant would pay for private care. If the schools were crumbling, the migrant would pay for private tutoring. But the system was built on a fragile foundation. It relied on the continued health and employment of the migrant. It relied on the stability of the foreign country. In the late 90s, as the world became more interconnected, we began to see the dangers of this total dependence. Any shift in the migration laws of the North was now an existential threat to the South. A crackdown on illegals in Florida meant hunger in a village in St. Vincent. The middleman continued to collect his fee, regardless of where the money came from or what it cost the person sending it. As we turned toward the new millennium, the technology began to change. The physical offices and the paper forms started to give way to digital pings. The speed increased again. But as the world moved faster, the underlying pressure remained the same. The debt was never fully paid. The obligation only grew. And soon, the entire system would face a shock that no one saw coming. The money kept moving, but the weight was becoming unbearable. Chapter 3: The Fragile Anchor. The 21st century brought the digital revolution to the remittance economy. The smartphone changed the way our history is written. Today, the migrant does not always have to stand in line at a yellow-signed office. They can send money with a thumbprint while sitting on a bus in Toronto. Digital wallets and mobile apps have lowered the fees in some areas, but the predatory nature of the system has simply evolved. The middleman is now an algorithm. We are now living in the era of the fragile anchor. Many Caribbean nations have reached a point of no return. In places like Haiti, remittances can account for nearly one-third of the entire gross domestic product. In Jamaica and Guyana, the figures remain staggering. We have reached a state where our national sovereignty is a polite fiction. A country cannot be truly independent if its daily survival depends on the discretionary income of people living under a different flag. This creates a dangerous political environment. When the lifeblood of the economy comes from the outside, the local government loses its incentive to be accountable to its own citizens. If the people at home are not the ones funding the state through a broad tax base, the state does not feel it has to serve them. The migrant is the ultimate silent partner. They pay the bills, but they have no vote. They see the corruption from afar. They see the roads they paid for remaining unpaved. They feel the frustration, but their only tool is to send more money to help their family bypass the broken system. The 2008 global financial crisis showed us the cracks in the anchor. When the housing market in the United States collapsed, the shockwaves hit the Caribbean harder than the initial earthquake. The construction workers in Nevada and the mortgage brokers in New York lost their jobs. Suddenly, the money stopped. The impact was immediate. In our islands, the grocery stores went quiet. Small businesses that relied on the remittance spend folded within months. It was a stark reminder that we are tethered to the whims of empires we do not control. We also see the rise of the deportee economy. Since the late 90s and accelerating into the present, northern governments have increased the rate of forced returns. Men and women who have spent 30 years in the diaspora, sending money home every month, are suddenly dropped back onto islands they no longer recognize. They arrive with nothing. The person who was once the provider becomes a burden. The cycle of obligation reverses, and the struggling family at home must now find ways to support a returnee who has no roots and no prospects. Today, we see the emergence of cryptocurrency and new fintech as a way to bypass the old middlemen. Some see this as a path to liberation. They hope that by removing the banks, we can finally keep the full value of our labor within our communities. But technology cannot solve a structural problem of extraction. Whether the money travels via a wire transfer or a blockchain, the fundamental reality remains. We are still exporting our best people to sustain a system that does not prioritize our growth. The human cost remains the most significant part of our history. We see it in the empty houses that dot the Caribbean landscape. These are the remittance mansions. They are grand, multi-story buildings with iron gates and beautiful balconies, built with decades of savings from the North. But often, they stand empty. The person who built them is still working in London, or they have passed away before they could retire back to the sun. These houses are monuments to a dream that is always just out of reach. They are the physical evidence of lives spent in two places at once, and nowhere at all. Our history teaches us that the remittance is a double-edged sword. It has saved millions from absolute poverty. It has educated our doctors and lawyers. It has kept our islands from total collapse during hurricanes and pandemics, but it has also allowed us to avoid the hard work of building self-sufficient nations. It has created a culture where the only exit from poverty is an exit from the country. As we look to the future, the question of obligation remains. The third and fourth generations of the diaspora are now coming of age. Their connection to the islands is different. They do not remember the smell of the charcoal fire or the sound of the rain on a galvanized roof. Their sense of obligation is thinner than that of their grandparents. If the flow of money slows, our islands face an existential crisis. We have built our modern world on the back of the migrant. We have used their love as a substitute for policy. The lifeblood is still pumping, but the heart is tired. We must ask what happens when the threads finally snap. We must ask what is left of us when the money stops moving. The barrel is empty. The screen is dark. The debt is still due.